In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about a field of research that is getting, as time goes along, more and more attention, something that countries, this one and others, are beginning to invest more and more money in. It's something that's occupying researchers at this university and a lot of other universities. It's nanotechnology, and if you know nothing else about it, you may understand that what we're talking about is really small stuff. But that may be about all that you know. This morning in this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about current developments in nanotechnology, talk a little bit about some of the applications. There are already products out there in the world that take advantage of nanoscale technology, and the expectation is that maybe within the next 5 or 10 or 20 years, there will be even more. Today and tomorrow here on the U of I campus, there is a conference going on to look at nanotechnology in homeland security. And perhaps we'll talk a little bit about that, too. This is sponsored by the U of I Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology, which is part of the College of Engineering. Here in the studio with me, we have three guests from different disciplines. Brenda Wilson is here. She is from the Department of Microbiology and also is part of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. Thomas Mackin is in the Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering. And David Kilner is here as well. He's a biological and environmental chemist, and he is the CEO of a company called Cavaton, which is interested in environmental monitoring and applying nanoscale technology to problems like that. We'll talk a little bit more about that and other things here. And questions, comments, of course, are welcome from people who are listening. I'm sure the panel will do their best to give you an answer. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
I think we should start out with talking in a basic kind of way about what it is we're talking about, because I expect that there will still be a lot of people who maybe have no idea what nanotechnology is, or, as I said at the beginning, they understand, well, it has to do with really small stuff. But other than that, that's probably all people know. Can each of you take a little turn? For someone who knows nothing about nanotechnology, where can you start in trying to explain to them what it is that this is about?
Well, what I would say is that we're talking about engineering structures, mechanisms, electronic devices, and we're engineering those devices on the nanoscale, which is the scale of about 1/10,000th the diameter of a human hair, 10 to the minus 9th meters. And so the challenges there are doing the engineering to build devices that we can manipulate on that scale and constructing deterministic engineering systems that will do things for us at the nanoscale.
Okay. So I guess, as I understand it, it's, if you think about it, if you're going to build something, what that object turns out to be, it's maybe limited or shaped by the blocks that you have to build. You big blocks, well, that's going to get you one kind of thing. But if you can use really small blocks, I mean, that is, if you can go down to the smallest kind of particles that you can possibly deal with, then that will give you greater flexibility in terms of what you can do as you build your thing, whatever it is that you're building. And here we're talking about just being able to build with smaller blocks than anybody has been able to build with in the past, I guess.
Right, that's correct. And it we're not only talking about the challenge of building at those very small scales using the smallest building blocks we've ever really manipulated, we're also talking about the unique properties that emerge in materials at those small scales. Materials are very strong. They have very interesting electrical properties. They have very interesting photonic properties. And so we want to exploit those interesting properties that we observe only at these small scales.
Hmm. Professor Wilson, can you talk a little bit about that, for example?
Right. If you take a look at the viewpoint from a biologist such as myself, what we view this nanotechnology as is an enabling tool that allows us to actually, one, see what we're looking at, because we work with these scales of objects all the time when we're dealing with cells, bacteria, viruses. All of these small, minute organisms are at a scale that we need to have tools to observe them with that deal with the nanoscale. And that's what nanotechnology allows us to do.
Mm-hmm. I'll just go and give David Kilner a turn next. And And maybe you can talk about taking that and then what it is that you can do with it.
Well, I think we're in a situation where we're working with structures that are a little bit bigger than these other people. We're actually on a micro scale. But as was just pointed out, we do, by going to these very small sizes, gain abilities that we wouldn't have with things on the macro scale. Our sensors are analogous to a fluorescent light, but made very, very small. And when you make it very, very small, you can then open it up to atmospheric pressures instead of having reduced pressures. And this is kind of the basis of why we can monitor environments and look for chemical warfare agents and stuff is entirely based on the size of the structure that we're using for our sensors.
If you don't mind, I'd like to add also that biology teaches us a lot. And in fact, a lot of nanoscale science and engineering uses biomimicry. We use the examples that biology provides. The molecular machinery of cells is going on at the nanoscale. So nature has proven to us that it can operate and operate in very elaborate and eloquent ways at the nanoscale. And we are attempting to do the same thing, constructing devices that would do similar sorts of things, but, you know, doing engineering with specific tasks.
Well, are you talking about building things atom by atom? Is that what we're talking about, or is it not that small?
It's not quite that small. I mean, people do talk about building things atom by atom. That's an extremely difficult thing to do. That's directed assembly. That's a very difficult thing to do if you're going to build up individual layers atom by atom. But we're talking about perhaps directed self-assembly, where these objects have a tendency to build themselves in a certain way, and then you sort of control that natural growth process so you get the geometries, the architectures, the shapes that you want.
It's more on the level of a molecule rather than an atom, I would say.
So that's it's still pretty small, but I guess in the scale of the world, there's a big difference between molecules and atoms.
A huge difference, actually, still. Yes.
We have a caller to talk with. Why don't we go ahead and bring them into the conversation on our line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. I was just wondering, what kind of precautions do scientists have to take in terms of safety? You're saying that these materials have unique properties, but are they sometimes unpredictable, or is there, you know, I suppose it depends on each individual case, the potential for something getting out of control?
Well, I would say that this is actually an issue of interest to everyone who's working in this field. We sort of feel like the first industrial revolution didn't get it right. We have the opportunity to get it right this time. So we are going to consider those sorts of implications from the beginning. The National Nanotechnology Initiative, which is funded by the federal government, actually has funding to support studies on environmental impacts, societal implications of these sorts of technologies. And so it is something that the researchers who are working in the field are interested in and are looking at very carefully.
Yeah, and I'd like to add to that that there are a number of collaborations now that are taking place between the engineers who are designing these entities and the biologists who will be testing them for safety. So I think that we're certainly developing ways that we can actually test and monitor for the safety. And certainly we're not going to put any product on the market that's going to be dangerous. And so we certainly are considering all of the implications in terms of health as well as other environmental impacts, safety, et cetera, issues.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just a little bit ago, David Kellner was talking about what it is they do. Can you talk a little bit more about current applications, things that take advantage of nanoscale technology that right now out there in the world are being used?
I can address that. In terms of those of us who are working actually with small organisms, we are using the nanotechnology to actually be able to observe the minute processes that these organisms undergo. We can detect them. We can see them actually move and how they work. We can monitor where they're going. And all of this is through many of the optical techniques that have been developed through nanotechnology, as well as through being able to just sense them and detect them. And that, I guess, the sensing aspect is what David was really getting at.
Mm-hmm. There's also a very interesting and benign example of a company that is using nanoscale particles in the fabrication of tennis balls. And the value of these is that they hold their pressure for a longer time than standard tennis ball manufacture. And so such a simple, mundane application like that using new nanoscale materials has really changed the market in tennis balls.
Well, I guess also one of the things that I've read about is that some of the newer stain-resistant fabrics.
Oh, right, nanochinos.
Yes, I guess those are the ones we see people in the commercials pouring wine on their pants, and then they just wipe it off, and it just rolls right off. So some of it it's not really all that exotic. Well, maybe the technology is exotic, but the applications are not particularly exotic.
Right, and we anticipate that this will develop more and more into more routine objects that we become very familiar with, and we don't even realize that we're actually dealing with the nanoscale in many of these objects. But they have properties that we can utilize and that allow us to advance our workings with the materials, et cetera.
Mm. Well, in terms of medical applications, for example, if you're able to better observe things on a very, very small scale, does that, for example, get you a better understanding of how the body works, of disease process, of viruses, of, you know, and anything
absolutely
like that?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we as biologists are actually doing. We are observing how entities that are nanoscale, such as toxins, viruses, they're all nanoscale particles, and they are interacting with ourselves. And so we can, by using the nano tools, we can observe them, watch where they're going, what they're doing, and we can also detect them at a very early stage, whereas before we had to wait until they became a lot more of them to be able to detect them. Now we can sense them in a much earlier stage when we can intervene and stop them from continuing on their proliferation, as what would happen in an infection, for example.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in having David Kellner talk a little bit more about what you do at Caviton in terms of practical applications. Just a little bit I have read about Caviton talks about environmental monitoring, for example, and you can imagine also applications of that for the security issues that this conference is all about. So tell me a little bit more about what the kinds of things that you do at Caviton.
So we're mostly a research and development firm at this point, and we're funded by several government entities, including the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Marine Corps, the Air Force, and we're about to start a contract for the Department of Energy. We're making monitors for things like trace amounts of metals coming out of smokestacks from coal-fired plants to help clean up the environment. We're also looking at other pollutants coming out of coal-fired plants and also jet engines and stuff, and doing performance monitoring of jet engines. Our Marine Corps project is to look for chemical warfare agents and toxic industrial chemicals, and so we're moving more in that direction. Sensitive detection and identification of chemical warfare agents. Mm.
So is the idea that you're able to detect smaller amounts, or that the detector itself is really small?
Well, the detector is really small, and they're very sensitive. We're looking at fluorescence from whatever these chemicals are, and so not only can we tell that there's a chemical present, but we can identify that molecule by the light that it's emitting in the discharge that we make. Mm.
So are we talking about, for example, making something that a soldier could have on the battlefield and could put in his pocket, or have a little button that would clip to his uniform or something like that that not only would not be a big burden to carry around, but also if the things we're talking about were really they're really small amounts, but they were there, that this thing would somehow it would say this thing is present?
So we have a wide range of devices going anywhere from very small detectors that don't really identify the molecule very well, but will give you a warning, so it could be used as a badge and an inexpensive sensor, all the way up to expensive high-end analytical instruments that are replacing, say, a 100-pound device with something that weighs less than 10 pounds and is battery-operated. So we're adding the ability to take a laboratory-grade instrument out into the field and have a rugged enough design that people can use it out in the fields of Iraq or when responding to fires or looking for meth labs or any of those.
So it's maybe not necessarily that there's no existing device that will do this, but that you're making something that is more portable, maybe easier to use, will work in less than optimum situation.
Yeah, many of these micro-scale and nano-scale devices are actually very, very simple devices. And since they're so simple, sometimes you gain reliability and you can generally reduce costs quite a bit and power consumption, and you can really change the way things are done by going to these much smaller sizes. And that's what we've done. We're now making devices that are 10 times smaller and cost 10 times less than what's currently available.
Mm. Yeah, I'd like to chime in on that. And, mm-hmm. and this is really a key to this nanotechnology. It's really following that notion that smaller, faster, cheaper devices are the way we want to go. The microelectronics industry has been doing this for years, and now with this new thinking in nanotechnology, we also understand that we can build very small sensors and detectors that we can build very cheaply to do things we had never been able to do before, you know, to sense things at levels that we could never sense before. And that's driving a lot of this, and that ties into Homeland Security as well, which the conference on campus is about. Mm-hmm. Homeland Security has kickstarted in a lot of ways this development of tech detectors to detect trace amounts of chemicals or biological organisms. But if we solve those problems, we'll also launch a new wave in medical diagnostics for real-time medical diagnostics.
Let me, for anybody who just has tuned in, I probably should introduce again all of our guests. Thomas Mackin, he's the last guy you heard. He's in the U of I's Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering. Brenda Wilson is in the Department of Microbiology, and both of them are associated with the U of I Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology. And also here's David Keller. He is a biological and environmental chemist, and is the CEO of a company called Cavaton. And he's talked a little bit about what it is that they do. They work on developing devices for environmental monitoring that take advantage of the kind of nanoscale technology that we are here talking about. They are all taking part in a conference, and a lot of other people too, here on this campus, looking at issues of homeland security and nanotechnology. It's sponsored by the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology that's part of the College of Engineering. And questions are welcome here if you'd like to call in, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Going back to the caller that called in right first and asked this question, you have to, anytime you're building something that doesn't exist in nature, something that is a novel thing, you do have to ask this question, well, what happens if we take that and introduce it into the environment? What kind of problems could there be? And certainly it's not hard to find examples of when you have some kind of physical system, an ecosystem, something like that, and you introduce something that's completely new, it is potentially a problem. When you're talking about this nanotechnology and being able to do engineering at that kind of level, are you really making something that is completely new, that didn't exist before? Or are you just kind of making improvements or doing, you know, how big is the differences that we're talking about between the kind of stuff that you could make using this technology and the sort of materials that you'd had before?
Well, I would say there are evolutionary examples of this technology. In a lot of ways, we're developing the tools so that we can manipulate things at a length scale we hadn't been able to do before. A lot of these things already exist. They just haven't been manipulated at these length scales. And in some cases, however, when we make very, very small powders, nanoscale powders, those weren't necessarily around in as much abundance as there might be now when we make some new materials. But you have to keep in mind that they don't necessarily easily disperse. They're very difficult to work with. They have a tendency to agglomerate and build, and form bigger clumps of material. So they don't necessarily like to exist in these small length scales. So you have to do things so that you can get them to have the structure you want at those scales. So I would say there's a little bit of both. There will be some things that are completely new, but in a lot of cases what we're trying to do is mimic or get new features out of things that already have existed in nature.
Hmm. We could talk with someone else here. Let's go to a caller in Urbana. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to make a couple of comments. I guess one of your guests mentioned that these nanomaterials can be very, very strong, and you can do things with these mechanisms that you can't do at larger scales. And since it's pretty much the program seems to be at a non-technical level, I just thought I'd kind of mention that there's this cliche that people learn and learn about and like to talk about that In the movies, you learn that an ant, can lift 80 times its own weight, and people think, well, that's really cool, because if you could just make the ant, the size of a human being, and the ant could, lift a whole building, and that you get all these horror movies about that. But actually, it's the whole reason the ant can do that is because the ant is so small, because if you take something and you make it 10 times smaller. Like the ant's muscles, get 100 times weaker because it's the cross section of the muscle that gives you the strength. So if you take an animal and you make it 10 times smaller, it gets 100 times weaker, but it also gets 1,000 times lighter because the animal's weight is related to its volume. And so when you make an object smaller, it gets stronger relative to its weight, and it's the same thing for a machine or an animal or whatever. And so if you go down to, well, I think the guest was saying like 10 to the minus 9 meters is the size, and so that's like making something a billion times smaller, and so you can just imagine how much heavier that would be.
No, I actually think you have a good point. It's an important point. And when we make very small materials, they're incredibly strong, and they're incredibly strong often because they're defect-free. And whereas bulk materials have lots of defects in them, even though you may not be able to see them, those defects limit the strength of those materials. And so I appreciate what the caller is saying, and you're right in a lot of ways. They will have these unique properties at the nanoscale. When you try to build really bulk samples from nanomaterials, you're going to lose most of those properties.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I just wanted to make one more comment, and I'll hang up and listen. Previous caller was asking what the dangers were from manufacturing nanotechnologies, and it struck me that maybe this is a very new technology, people don't know about it, and I could see how people know Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and. And, people know that, nuclear technology was very dangerous. People found out that it is. And so people might be, might wonder, okay, well, is another technology going to be dangerous also? And so they might be afraid of it just because they don't know about nanotechnology. I guess my only input, and again, I'll hang up and listen, my input would be that it strikes me that nanotechnology would not be dangerous to manufacture. That's not too bad of a deal. The biggest danger I would see in nanotechnology is what happens when it gets out and is used, and maybe you have little nano cameras watching people, or little nanomolecules running around polluting the environment. But anyway, I just want to make that comment, and I'll listen and see what you have to say.
Okay, well, thanks. You all can comment on that any way you like.
Well, I just want to say that the key to any technology and alleviating the fear of the public about these things is education. And this is exactly what we're here today to do, is to try to explain some of this to everyone and to let them understand that we're not dealing with, you know, new things that are going to be blowing up things and causing a lot of problems. And certainly that we are aware of some of the dangers and that we want to be able to address them in a systematic and rational way.
Yeah. I just want to also tell other people who are listening, if you have questions, the caller observed that it was not a very technical discussion, and that's because I'm not really capable of carrying on a real technical discussion on these issues. But, of course, anybody who has questions can call in and ask them, and I know our guests will take their best shot. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I guess from my perspective, the thing that catches my interest, or one of the things catch my interest, is potential applications. I mean, what really can you do with this? And I think that at least helps me to understand a little bit better about what it is we're really talking about. And I wonder, can you maybe give some more examples of potential applications, either existing applications or what it is that you think you would like to be able to do or could do, just given the time and the experience and the research?
There are incredible number of terrific potential applications, and the one that resonates most strongly with most people are the applications in the healthcare industry, for instance. As we begin to understand the forces that occur on the nanoscale and as we can manufacture at the nanoscale, there's this drive for targeted drug delivery, targeted imaging, so that we could, for instance, take nanoscale particles of gold, attach a molecule to them that will react with and only with a cancer cell, and then that will go throughout the body, attach itself to the cancer cells. Then you can image those cells specifically by you deliver in image enhancing agents, or you can deliver drugs to those specific cells. And so when you begin to understand the interactions at the nanoscale and you can control or target those interactions, it opens the possibility of new medical treatments that we have never had before. Targeted drug delivery and enhanced imaging are two of the really big applications that are getting closer every day.
Right, and another example dealing with the Homeland Security issue is being able to actually read whether a person has actually been exposed to a toxin, for instance. The potency of many of these toxins is so great that you only need 1 to 10 molecules of, and I'm saying one molecule, okay, in a volume of, say, a milliliter. That's enough to cause paralysis in the case of some of these neurotoxins. And the nanotechnology is allowing us to actually detect that scale, that level of these agents. And so we can actually make diagnostics and be able to know, has this person been exposed to that toxin? And that's, you know, one of the major ways that we can do this. We can separate using nanofluidics, which would be separation methods that, again, use pores that are on the nanoscale in diameter and that force just single molecules to go through them, we can use those materials to actually separate very precisely the toxins that we'd be looking at from other things that might be present in the environment or in the blood or whatever samples that we're looking at. And we can then be able to use them and to determine exactly what is there and identify what they are.
And that's something that you cannot do with present technology?
No. The beauty of the nanofluidics is actually because you are dealing with single molecules interacting with a single pore, the properties that you encounter at that level is very different than you do at the micro scale where you're dealing at that level with bulk forces. And the physics is actually quite different. The chemistry is very different at those levels.
We have some other callers. Let's talk next with someone in Washington, Illinois, on line number 4. Hello.
What I was just wondering was, first off, what would be some websites and some good resources for finding out more about nanotechnology? And also, are you still basically using macro scale techniques to make these things? That is, I was at a seminar talking about the disk drive heads that IBM makes, and they blew off the name nanotechnology based on, no, our stuff isn't nanotechnology, it works. And is this basically like making chips, except still using macro scale stuff, you're just going to another level?
Can you?
Well, several things. You could visit the website of the Center for Nanoscale Science and Technology on campus. It would be www.cnst.uiuc.edu. You can always also go to www.nano.gov. Another great one is nanotechweb.org. That's the one for Europe. So those are some terrific sites so you can learn more about it. As far as manufacturing goes, manufacturing is the challenge. Boy, you really hit the nail on the head there. A lot of the manufacturing that we're trying to do now are extensions of ways that we did things in the past. We're using examples from microelectronics industry to try to pattern things. We are using the atomic force microscope to move atoms and molecules around. And so it's a challenge. I would say that you really hit the nail on the head there, that the manufacturing things is a really interesting and difficult challenge.
If I could ask one more question.
Sure.
Has anyone come up with a micro-scale atomic force microscope that makes manufacturing something as opposed to experimenting with a tiny area practical?
Well, I don't know if manufacturing is – I don't know if you'd say manufacturing yet, but there are two interesting applications. Chad Merkin out of Northwestern has developed something called dip pen nanolithography, where he uses an atomic force microscope to write molecules onto a surface. And he has worked very closely with a person on campus here named Chang Liu in electrical engineering. Chang Liu has now made massively parallel arrays of these little micro beams. Think of them as little micro pencils that can then write molecules onto a surface.
I guess I didn't mean manufacturing. Can he actually make things as big as, say, 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter, or, say, 5 by 5 centimeters, that size?
By starting at the nanoscale and building up?
Yeah.
I'm not using AFMs.
Okay, so it's like maybe a micron by a micron?
I don't even know if I'd go that far.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
So another quick point is we're more on the micro scale, but we actually drill holes in things with drill bits as small as 50 micron and stuff. So a lot of the real mechanical ways of doing things can still be used down to the micro scale. Once you get below that, it gets
well, how make a comparison between 50 microns and something we'd know what the size of?
So maybe a quarter the size of a human hair.
Okay.
Is the end of the drill bit.
Okay, so we are talking about not only using sort of our conventional technologies, that is, existing machines to work on the nanoscale, but also we're looking at making nanoscale machines to do nanoscale work.
We're not making nanoscale machines. We're making microscale machines.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay.
And we are right now in this era, in this research, where we're developing the tools. We need tools in order to manipulate things reliably and predictably on these nanoscales. And right now, I would say we're in the stage where we're developing the tools.
Yeah. I guess that's the place where people's imagination gets to run a little bit wild when you read things about nanomachines, you know, and little machines that can make other machines, and that's where you get into your runaway technology scenarios. We're saying we're not there yet, but that we might, or would you say that's
It's sort of hard to imagine
we ever would be there.
Well, if you take nature as an example, nature already is doing that with viruses, which are clearly at the nanoscale, and they are self-replicating, and they do it on their own. So can we do that? No, we can't do that right yet, just yet. Will we be able to? Maybe. Will we want to? I don't know. So we're at such an early stage in this area that at each step of the direction that we go in, we have to evaluate whether we really want to do this or not.
You're bringing up something interesting. It was actually Michael Crichton's book, Prey, and the movie will be coming out soon, talks about these self-replicating nanobots. Mm-hmm. We're certainly not there. I think to be fair to those people who are listening, you could also go to a website, www.foresight.org, which is started by Drexler. In many ways, he sort of really kicked off the whole nanotechnology revolution. And Drexler's thesis is that you must build these molecular machines. And so if they want to learn, no one is doing that, but Drexler's notion is that's something that we want to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you could do that, then what would it enable you to do that you can't do now? I mean, what would you do if you had that kind of machine, if you had nanobots, what could you imagine doing with them?
Oh, I would say that it would be a relatively non-invasive way of getting access to locations, say, in the body where there might be a tumor or something like that, where mm-hmm. otherwise you would have to use surgery or something that might be very dangerous. And we wouldn't be able to do that at this point. If you could have something like that that would go to those sites, do the, you know, remove the damaging, you know, area, and then again retreat, then it would be an ideal situation. I mean, we certainly can't do that yet, but it would be nice if there would be some way that we can.
All right. Let's talk with somebody else here. We have a caller in Kankakee on our line 4. Hello.
Howdy. Mm-hmm. This is interesting because last month, the Washington Post's National Weekly Edition, that was their cover article on nanotechnologies, their April 5th through 11th issue. And you know, I knew a little bit about, very little about nanotechnology, but some. And I was, they listed all the amazing products that are coming out. And it just seems like our limit is our imagination as to what's possible with nanotechnology. But they also brought up some areas that I had no idea about, some of the potential problems. They were talking about that they're finding lung lesions in what little studies they're doing with rats with carbon nanotubes, and that there's not that much in the way of safety. Some safety devices aren't up to par to deal with the size of nanoparticles for the workers and such. They were talking about that on the plus side, it can be amazingly useful for some ecological cleanups of waste sites and such. But part of the way they do it, I gather, is by free radical production, and that's potentially lethal to good soil bacteria, and that studies related to that are minimal right now. And in general, there's no rules for the disbursement of nanoparticles. They describe it as nano litter, and that the EPA is just barely getting started doing research. That research in general is pretty minimal on potential health hazards and environmental hazards. And the bill that just came up in Congress, they were saying that they eliminated a minimal dollar amount for studies for environmental concerns, and that a lot of the efforts put out is just to allay worries by the public. I guess my big question is, what kind of efforts are being put out, serious efforts, to check potential problems? I mean, at one time we thought that asbestos and DDT were great things.
Yeah, these are good points. I think that the nanotube studies on rats, you can find that at Vicky Colvin's group at Rice University. Rice University also houses the person who discovered the buckyball, Rick Smalley. That group has done all of the key work in carbon, not all, but a lot of the work in carbon nanotubes. And their center there takes very seriously these environmental issues, and in fact put Vicky Colvin, a chemist, onto that particular topic area full time. And so there more and more centers around the country are devoting a portion, I would say on the order of 10% of their budgets, to studies of these environmental impact issues. So it is something that is important, and more more organizations are really trying to get it right this time by devoting certain amounts of all of their funding to study these issues.
Do you see any kind of effort from the government side? I mean, it seems like our current administration poo-poos environmentalism big time.
Well, that's a somewhat anti-regulatory administration. So.
Well, but in fact, we do have an Office of Science and Technology. One of the speakers at our conference today and tomorrow, actually she's talking today, is looking into exactly these sorts of things, Cecilia Marsbacher. And she is heading up that area and looking at safety issues involved with nanotechnology.
Well, very good. Carry on.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I guess that does, you know, we were talking a little bit ago about runaway nanobots, and that's interesting to think about that, but it does seem that there is a greater and a more real potential just simply to think of nanotechnology and as something that's going to generate some new and novel environmental pollutants and hazards, things that are maybe sort of like what we have now, just new. How worried should we be about something like that?
Silence. No.
I know that's a pretty open. That's a pretty open.
You know, it's
question.
Just proper scientific stewardship. We should just make sure that we are always thinking about these issues and paying attention to these issues while we are doing the research, so that we do not ignore any of these potential consequences. Everything comes with consequences. You just want to understand it so that you can understand what the consequences are. And so I think it is important for people to continue to say, look, we want to do this responsibly. I think that a great many of us do want to conduct this research in a responsible way so that we can reap the rewards and minimize any of the potential negative consequences.
Right, and currently, much of this is actually still at the research stage, so it really is not done on a very large scale presently for many things. There may be some examples like a tennis ball, but certainly the vast majority of it is actually done in the laboratories and under controlled conditions.
It's also important to point out that nanotechnology covers an incredibly broad range of applications that just all happen to be on the same size scale. Many of these devices that people are working on are just mechanical devices that would be kept on a chip and wouldn't pose any threat to anything. Mm-hmm. There are some applications that do have potential problems coming up, but we all try and do our best to make sure we keep that in mind as we do the research.
All right, let's talk with another caller here, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm sorry I turned in late. You may have touched on this, but would you recommend William Atkinson's book, Nanocosm, as a good introduction for the general reader?
Any comments?
I think it's understandable. I imagine it would be probably okay for someone that's at the undergraduate level.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
All right. That's what but not for someone who didn't have at least a little bit of
I think you need a little
background.
Bit more. Well, I don't know. My son actually is into this sort of thing, and he read the book. So he read it when he was a junior in high school, but he was attending college too at the same time.
So that doesn't
fit the profile. So I'm not really sure, but And he found it to be, he had questions that he would ask, so I don't know. I imagine that there would be.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember, what's the best lay book in nanotechnology? That's what I'm trying to recall.
I was trying to think of something myself, and I don't really know, but.
Although
that would not be a bad book, and you certainly, the introductory chapters or the beginning parts of it would probably be pretty good to read.
Okay. So certainly I do know from looking around on the web there is an awful lot of material dealing with nanotechnology out there. Mm-hmm. Scientific American has collected a lot of the stuff
yes,
that they
actually,
have published
they do
on,
have
on
articles
site.
About this. So yeah. Probably that might actually be a really good source to go to is actually some of the Scientific American articles.
Right.
And even the scientist has sometimes some articles on this sort of thing too.
We have about 7-8 minutes left. If someone has a question they want to call real quick, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How much research money is going into this, and how much money comes from public sources and how much money comes from private sources? Is that something that you have some kind of handle on?
The federal investment is on the order of $800 million, and that comprises many different agencies from the NSF, DOE, EPA, DOD. So it's a rather significant one, and it's growing every year. It happens to be one of those areas that has bipartisan support, and so there don't seem to be very many contentious issues about the need to do nanotechnology research. So it's growing at a pretty good clip. It's approaching $1 billion a year in research funding. And so the federal investment is rather substantial in nanotechnology. I'm not sure about the private investment. It is substantial as well, but I don't know what the numbers happen to be.
I'm not sure what the total numbers are. Us as a company are about 20% private research money and 80% government research.
Hmm. How about, can you say something about how spending how much we, the United States, has spent, that is how much the U.S. government is spending in comparison to what other countries are spending?
Other countries are Japan and let's just say all of Europe. They have exceeded our expenditures. They've decided that Europe especially, Japan as well, feel in many ways that they missed out on the internet technology boom, and they aren't going to let it happen to them this time. So they are dead set on being leaders in nanotechnology. And so Japan especially tracks our budgets, and they make sure they either match or exceed all of our budgets in nanotechnology. And Europe has a very serious commitment to nanotechnology. So the worldwide investment exceeds our own. And certain other countries actually exceed our own investment as well.
Let's talk with some other folks here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of the research that takes place in the nanotech field is applied research. I was wondering what areas of basic research out there do you feel are, or do you think are taking place that would be applicable to the further advancement of nanotech development?
Whoever wants to respond can. It's interesting that you say that it's applied. I would say that there is a technology pool. This, and I'll use sensors as an example. A lot of people call this the decade of the sensor because there's this pool by Homeland Security to develop new sensor technologies, and that there's also a pool by the medical community to develop new sensor technologies for real-time imaging. And so you would say, hey, this technology pool makes this applied research, but there are so many fundamental questions that need to be addressed that it's still a large component of all of that is fundamental research. How do you build a detector that can detect such incredibly small quantities like Brenda was talking about and do it reliably with low false positive rates? How do you target a specific molecule and not bond with some other molecule? These are very challenging fundamental questions.
Yeah, we're really, although we're trying to apply a lot of the applications, we are currently probably devoting a good 80, maybe 90% of the time to just basically understanding how things are working and how we can get them to work better. So yes, it's applied research, but really we're at such a early stage in our development in this field that we are still very much at the research and development stage.
Well, from a company standpoint, everything we're doing is applied research, but we do have real close ties with the University of Illinois and Gary Eden's lab in the Department of Electrical Engineering. And what we do is try and put some of our research money back into basic research to improve our technology for further down the road. So I really get the feeling that most of the nanotechnology money goes into basic research, and there's only a few companies out there that are starting to apply this into product-type situations.
I'm trying to get one more caller in here in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, just getting back to the safety and the unintended consequences business, I'd just like to remind everybody that, once a technology is developed, then it leaves the hands of the scientists and gets into the hands of, well, ultimately, possibly, governments, politicians, and that sort of thing. And it also leaves the particular country in which it was developed. And so many of the problems that have developed in the past are not really the responsibility of the scientists. We're not essentially caused by the scientists, but were caused by the politicians and so forth. I'm reminded of the Manhattan Project and the fact that a lot of the scientists were the opinion that, okay, this thing we're developing is so horrible it'll never be used. But then when it was developed and got into the hands of the politicians, it was used.
Well, I appreciate the comment. We're coming down to the point where we maybe have about a minute or so. Is there any sort of last thought that you would like to leave people with?
Well, I think just to address that, I think that those are all issues that we constantly have to deal with. And I don't think that we can stop the advancement of science and this technology. It's already there. If the concept is out there, it's available. And it can be done. And I guess what we need to do is try our best to, one, educate others about these issues and try to tell both positive and negative aspects and then let some of the policymakers actually try to alleviate some of the consequences that might result.
Yeah,
I would also add that I think researchers need to be good citizens as well. I mean, we need to participate in the political process. We can't just stay in the lab, do our work, and wash our hands of everything. I do think we need to be active citizens and participate.
Well, I'm going to have to leave it at that. We come to the end of the time. I want to say thanks very much to our guests, Thomas Mackin from the Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering at U of I, Brenda Wilson from the Department of Microbiology, and both of them are